This is Reality Proves Possibility, an exploration of human ingenuity. This is Reality Proves Possibility, and I'm Michael Pearson, and I'm honored to be here with Rakesh Khurana, who has a storied career and is a renowned scholar in the field of leadership and leadership development and business education. Rakesh is the Marvin Bauer Professor of Leadership Development at Harvard Business School and has served for over a decade as the Danoff Dean at Harvard College, where he helped shape the formation of undergraduate education and leadership at one of the world's most influential institutions. Through his scholarships, including From Hired Aims to Hired Hands, he has challenged us to rethink the purpose of business and to recover a deeper sense of professional and moral responsibility in leadership and specifically business education. Rakesh, in this podcast, we explore the idea that better forms of business and leadership are not only necessary, but already emerging, that reality in many places is proving that possibility. So let me start with asking that question. What is your reaction to the title of the show, Reality Proves Possibility, and the underlying claim that we can, in fact, do better than this?
Okay. First of all, thank you for inviting me. Just really grateful to be here. It means a great deal. Michael, as you know, I'm a huge fan of your work. I really love the title because I think in many ways, what we have seen, at least from a kind of sociological and social sense of the way the world works, is that human beings are not very good with abstractions. Most people aren't. Maybe the narrow group of us who become academics are. But actually that there's always change going on, but it's usually not in the center and it's not always in our view. There's this idea in anthropology, which I really like, called prefigurative communities. And the idea is that often on the edges of institutions and systems, there's always something slightly different going on, experiments going on. They're prefigurative of future practices, prefigurative of different types of innovations and ideas. And I think there is a lot of prefigurative work going on. It's just not always visible to us. And for me, it's always a center of hope and possibility. I wish there was more of it going on. I think part of the challenge we face in many ways in places like business education is that we impoverish the imaginations of our students and increasingly even our doctoral students who are our future faculty.
Yeah, well, and your work, I mean, is at the center and you have been surrounded by this. And it's really a privilege to hear your perspective on what imagination can we develop, right? What prefigurative, I think it is, communities or constellations are there that we can build on? If I recall in your book, you basically laid out the whole business education endeavor was at least legitimized through a higher calling, a higher purpose. And I think your work as the dean of one of the most prominent institutions, and I think you remind people a lot, it's like the purpose is to create citizens for a democracy, right? And I think in many ways, that is not so clearly at the forefront in business education or in education at large, right? And I'd like you to just like share some of your current thinking about that and maybe also go back to the research that you have done and why you have emerged on that research, because it's not a typical kind of work that somebody would engage in, because it is a fantastic scholarly work. I really, really appreciated it at the time and still do. So thank you so much for doing it. But it's not a conventional work.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's always been motivated for me, partly by like, you know, when I look at the sort of work I've done and the work I'm doing, is I've always really been interested in how did we get here and who were the people who brought us to the current moment. And I think in many ways, I was really interested in institutions. I was interested in my early work on how did we get to this idea of that the purpose of the corporation was to maximize shareholder value. And a lot of my early work focused on that. And then the kinds of leaders that we would be selecting if that was the sort of accepted purpose of the firm, and commenting on, you know, what challenges that would present. And then I think the second part was, you know, what are the institutions that educate people to think this way? And, you know, for me, I think about, you know, we've built institutions, companies, professional schools, universities and, you know, careers that are extraordinarily good at producing a very sort of narrow set of results and maybe scaling certain types of activities. And yet at the same time, when we would measure them using kind of more capacious long-term measures, more inclusive of human beings flourishing, And even inside the organization, so many people seem to be experiencing their work as disconnected from any deeper sense of purpose. And I think humans are purpose-seeking individuals and groups and societies. And so part of my research I've been trying to understand is how has that been kind of marginalized to the side? And how were systems that were originally decided by the entrepreneurs who created them to serve human ends, such as education and innovation, corporations, gradually come to reorganize around kind of internal logics that are quite narrow, that end up emphasizing metrics, narrowly defined roles and credentials. And so in some ways, when the means and the ends flip, and this is where, you know, it's kind of animated my work. It's what excites me about the work that you do and all the conferences you organize, is you're pushing us, you know, for the possibility to kind of challenge what we've normalized, entire categories of work, entire categories and ways of thinking about ourselves that actually have hollowed out humanity, in which many people are experiencing themselves as meaningless or not finding meaning in work, which, you know, it had for an extraordinary period of human life been at least one of the sources of meaning.
Yeah, and you give an account of business education as sort of flipping intentionally, right? It was like, by design, something at least legitimized, coded in the higher aims of higher education, legitimizing business leaders or managers at the time that emerged as a new sort of cadre of organization and stewardship. And they didn't have the privilege and the esteem or status in society. So they mimicked that and wanted to have it, it seemed like. And then in the end, really in a short amount of time, that flipped. Through a constellation of actors that you're describing, right? And I think there is something in that reality that proves a possibility that, yeah, those things shift, they can shift. How do they shift? And if you can bring us back just sort of to the highlights, sure. What do you see? What are some of the key shifts that happened there that maybe can be replicated or maybe need to be adapted if one wanted to flip it back?
So, yeah, and I think I'd be cautious about flipping back.
Right.
You know, we have to kind of move forward, but maybe we can use some of those animating ideas as a source of renewal. And so the animating ideas was that society was undergoing a dramatic shift. We were shifting from an agrarian to an industrial society, the changing nature of work. People were no longer working for themselves. They were increasingly working for corporations. That in many cases, the nature of work is shifting from craft to de-skilling on the assembly line. You had the rise of a great deal of labor violence in the United States, to take that as the context that I was studying in. Huge demographic changes, incredible amounts of immigration, shift from rural to city. And it was in that context that the social order was breaking down. And there was a lot of discussion about on what basis could this new social order be constructed? And there was a recognition that the market itself couldn't offer enough to really create a kind of social order in which trust would flourish and democracy would flourish. And it was in that context, which we now often, you know, recognize as the era of progressivism and populism and the debates around that, that this notion that, you know, that the corporation was having such a big impact on shaping life, it couldn't simply be run in a kind of narrow Darwinian logic, like that the sort of many of the sort of robber barons is what they were called then, you know, wanted to run society by. And it couldn't be run in traditional ways where you know, there was a lot of debate. Maybe we should just break these up and kind of go back to a traditional life. You know, the thing is, once something's invented, you can't put it back in the bottle. Human beings are pretty smart. And so the idea was, could we reconceptualize this? And the idea was that we should see the leaders of these organizations, because of the wide impact they have on the social welfare, maybe we could see them as professionals. And and at that time, the idea of management and running these organizations was being increasingly debated as one resting on a foundation of knowledge. So there was things like scientific management, which had coming out, that there was a body of knowledge to be mastered, that this knowledge actually had a continuing basis, that it could be understood objectively and in a disinterested way. And so there was an argument that, you know, there was many sort of technical for-profit business schools that existed at the time teaching accounting and typography, that they could be brought into the university. And basically, because they were going to increasingly operate on a scientific basis as well, in addition to being seen as professionals. And by professionals, it meant that you would use that objective knowledge, not for the benefit for a narrow concern, but rather for the benefit of the larger society. And the third element would be that you didn't need regulation then, because since it was a profession, it would be self-regulating, that you could count on a kind of community of professionals to build a set of norms that would allow, you know, business to be managed in a way that didn't require heavy hand of the state. And so that was the sort of framing and the connections to existing institutions that gave rise to the business school. That model, as you noted, it was successful in establishing and legitimating business education in universities, but it had a really more challenging time institutionalizing itself in the broader case. Although I would say, you know, the institutionalization did last, and there was a lot of different progress to it, which ranged from how do we raise the caliber of the students, what should be the subjects the students are taught, how do we raise the caliber of the faculty. But in many ways, you know, beginning in the early 1970s, the idea that the purpose of the corporation had more than just, that had a social purpose came to be contested. And the idea that managers should see their role as satisfying a broad set of constituencies in an effort to run corporations for the broader interests of society became contested. And, you know, in hindsight, we now know that a lot of that, and in my research, you know, I think it's not common knowledge, came from the work of Milton Friedman. It came from the work of Hayek and others who were involved in a kind of, you know, a different kind of intellectual project. And essentially over the subsequent two decades into the 80s, you know, and through lots of contestation, this idea that the purpose of the corporation was to maximize shareholder value and that the firm was basically a social fiction that really didn't have any kind of sociological or cultural or content, and that it was simply a nexus of contracts, and that CEOs were not professionals, but rather agents who couldn't be trusted to run firms and had to be so-called, have their incentives aligned to those of the shareholders. That increasingly gained a great deal of traction, then eventually became very deeply institutionalized in business education in the 80s and 90s.
So there was an intellectual project that at the beginning had very little traction, right? So if you trace it back to the origin of the Mont Pelerin Society and people in it and trying to figure out what it could be, sort of a response, I think at the time, a legitimate response to the threat of totalitarianism on different ends, right? And then sort of landing on that market as the dominant institution and then influencing through that market logic education, which then is what we sort of have as the legitimizer of a dominant framework and all the quote unquote fictions, or you say impoverished assumptions behind it. Can you share a little bit how that transition worked, and maybe just briefly, because I think there was some institutions involved in that shift that is sort of really interesting to note, and how that happened with some of the lighthouse institutions, the intentionality behind it, the funding behind it, the standardization behind it, et cetera. Could you just share a little bit again?
Sure. You know, I think one thing to note is that there was always a little bit of contestation behind the idea of business having a societal purpose that even began almost immediately when this idea of management as a profession emerged. So, you know, you named a lot of institutions and organizations, and I think, you know, as people have been studying the rise of how did we get here, this notion of what we sometimes now call neoliberalism, that, you know, it was a project and that there was, for a variety of reasons, some of it was motivated by the Cold War and others was just purely ideologically motivated before there was even a Cold War. The Walgreen Foundation was funding in University of Chicago in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, already a kind of protest against this idea of management as a profession and whether it had like kind of socialistic ideals or something embedded in it. And, you know, that happened again in the 1950s when the Ford Foundation, at that time briefly led by Robert Maynard Hutchins, who had been the former president of the University of Chicago and wanted to sort of make sure that our institutions were well aligned to democracy. When he was removed as president and then replaced by Donald David, who was the former dean of Harvard Business School, who was definitely more of a person who held kind of views that we would associate with kind of Cold War fears. And, you know, it changed the nature of business education, was the first view that they thought they had, that David thought they had to do. And that was to professionalize the faculty so that the faculty itself would be basically more discipline oriented. And in particular, in the 1930s, the disciplines that had been privileged increasingly in business schools were things like industrial psychology, industrial sociology, anthropology. And this is, you know, aligned with the with the Great Depression, with the failure of markets that, you know, basically created the great economic depressions of the time. You know, so you had this like a brief ascent of, you know, a more capacious set of social sciences, and many of them were interdisciplinary, forming business education. But in the 1950s, they were sort of, you know, they continued to persist, but they were definitely facing many more headwinds, when the idea was that actually what we needed to do was anchor business education research in disciplinary training, and not in grand theory, but middle range, very empirically bound, the things that you can count. And as we all know, all the things that count can't always be counted. But that would be the way that business education would be pursued. And that really involved a recalibration and a reconfiguration of management doctoral programs. Hmm. And they were anchored at five institutions at that time: Carnegie Mellon, Harvard, University of Chicago, Columbia, and Stanford. And that's where we saw a lot of the significant reconfiguration in doctoral program and doctoral education take place.
So that's one of the levers of transformation, right? And you also have, I think, reported that the Carnegie Foundation report, or some kind of Carnegie report, right, was contributing to, quote unquote, legitimizing that professionalization project, but professionalization in that way that you're describing in the academic domain, and feeding into that logic that maybe now is giving rise to the conversation that you describe as the leadership conversation, right? Where it's like, okay, before you sort of take out the human, make it dispassionate, and then you feel that you need to put it back in at to the back door, right?
Yeah, I mean, it always ends up being like an afterthought. I mean, look, you know, I'm now of the age where I can speak very candidly about things, right? So, you know, if you sit around a boardroom, or you sit around any, you know, you'll always see somebody stroke their beard and say, well, the tone is set at the top. And you know what? Maybe the tone has been set at the top, that maybe it's our leading institutions that have brought us to this moment, and the people who've been running them, who have not advocated, have not pushed back appropriately to find the right balance in which our institutions are serving us as humans rather than us serving them. And I think that, to me, is the real sort of challenge, is that we should be demanding that organizations and our economy should serve human purposes, not the other way around. And I think that, you know, if we look at some of the challenges that we face, in so many cases, the institutions that we trust have inverted the relationship, and the metrics become the point rather than the purpose that were originally set up for. And I think that this isn't just a sort of issue of inefficiency, or that the organizations need some tweaking. It goes back to what you said earlier, that, you know, when we talked about the Mount Pelerin Society and, you know, Hayek and others, is that they were afraid of totalitarianism. Well, what do we mean by totalitarianism? Totalitarianism has in it the prefix totality, this idea that there's only a totalizing way of looking at the world. And in some ways, if you only think about market logic, and you only think about the firm as a nexus of individual contracts, and that the sole purpose of the firm is to maximizing shareholder value, how is that totalizing logic any different from any other type of totalizing logic?
Yeah, I mean, it's the dominance of a paradigm, and that's sort of been, I think, as you're describing it, brought down by the top, and most people aren't really aware of that totality, of that capture, right? That mental capture, that foregrounding of a certain logic. And I think I've heard you say many times, yes, we need to break this up, and we need to have a pluralistic approach, if that's a correct understanding. But I'm sensing, like, what is another, because I'm struggling with this personally, and I'd like your intellectual challenge on that. I think there is always going to be somehow a paradigm that dominates. The question is which, and how open is that to debate internally, right? And so in that sense, the totalitarian kind of dominant paradigm that we're experiencing now has run its course, right? I think you see the reaction on the political domain is a reversion to another paradigm that actually happened in a very short amount of time. That's how I read the events in the United States, right? But it is a story that sort of repeats itself. And the question is, like, what do you think can be, if we need one paradigm, maybe you say we don't need one, maybe we need to be able to hold plural at the same time, right? But what would be one that is preferable to that, well, the totalitarian or fascist or market-based neoliberal, whatever you want to call them, label them. I don't know if it's helpful.
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't have an easy answer. I have some thoughts, and I'm hoping in our conversation to outline some of those. And, you know, but there, I would want to sort of say it's far from a kind of complete picture. And I don't think I should have a complete picture because one thing, you know, you said is that a lot of people don't even realize they're in this paradigm. I would slightly disagree with you. Mm. I think people do realize it. They just don't know what, maybe this is a slightly different way of saying what you were saying. They don't know what the alternative is, okay? But I think they do realize it because we have seen an incredible amount of alienation in our society. When everything looks like successful for a narrow group of people or from a few people, but it doesn't feel like that way for everyone else. I think we see, you know, maybe this is what you were referring to in our politics and in our just social health. I think we see a lot of alienation. Now, I think your question in some ways about whether there's another paradigm, I think one of the reasons I liked but I'm willing to be convinced and persuaded the other way I'm always open to having my mind changed, but my mom always said, you should always have an open mind, but not so open that your brain falls out. So I'm open to having my mind changed. But one reason I gave so much salience to the idea of professionalism is I recognize that one way professionalism can be a kind of double-edged element. Because on the one hand, as you know, we saw what the Carnegie and the Ford Foundation tried to do is they wanted to bring standards, and they felt that disciplined thinking, that is precise, ordered thinking, and a commitment to getting things right rather than ideologically is important. But I think what got lost in that is that the original people also pushing management as a profession, but actually pushing any professions, whether it's in medicine or law, was that it was not about outsourcing moral judgment to a paradigm. In fact, the word judgment was really important. It wasn't about an algorithm. It couldn't be replaced by a ChatGPT, you know, easy answer. But it was about the exercise of judgment. And in order to avoid the ideological closure, one thing about a profession is that it's not about an individual. It exists in context. It is part of a community. It is linked to community logic. And as a result, if you had diverse groups of people in that community, you could debate and discuss different ways of approaching, and you would exercise professional judgment about how to use your skills and toward what end. I think the word profession still holds for many people a kind of resonance. It's a kind of sacred term. And, you know, I think it moves us away from, well, I'm just doing my job, or the market made me do it. And so for me, I think this is part of what we have to kind of bring together is, how can we be attentive to a system? How can we be attentive to a system that can operate with rational intention, but toward humanistic outcomes? How can we make sure that a system like that, for the people who are participating in it, doesn't feel hollow or empty, or even worse, coercive? And so for me, the question is, how do we reconnect all of these elements back together is really the opportunity that we have inside of it. One aspect of it is, I think that, you know, some of the reasons that things have become so kind of difficult to imagine alternatives to is not simply the market logic, Michael. I think we've also adapted this incredible bureaucratic logic that also impoverishes our imagination, in which we think, okay, if we have a problem, the way to respond to it is by creating authoritative rules and, you know, having benchmarks and all of these things. Now what you end up is with bureaucrats. And so, you know, I think, again, this is the kind of thing where I think de Tocqueville and others also recognize you don't want to have either people motivated by maximum amount of individualism, and you don't want to have like a large state bureaucracy, even if that takes place in a corporation, to be doing that. What you need is these middle range elements. And you know, and I think this is the part that's really been hollowed out, is this middle. And so we have these binaries that we're constantly navigating. And my side of the coin is better than your side of the coin. And the fact that binaries have really impoverished our way of actually thinking.
So that's the middle range, the community ship other people may talk about, right? Is like where Tocqueville and others are. It's like that's where the richness of life can emerge. That's where people feel seen and heard, which they don't if they're anonymized in a bureaucratic top-down structure, command and control, or the market where it's pricing coordination. And you're mentioning judgment and leadership as sort of key to the professionalization project. Is that, that's, I think, your animating idea from business education in some way, but how would it look like to recapture that in your mind? How would it, yeah. What would it look like if we were to bring that spirit back and maybe a multimodality of organizing forms that then blend? And I'm sure you know this grammar work of organizing, right? Which you're referring to, right? So like, how can we be using these multiple grammars in a new language? I don't know if that's a good metaphor, but...
Yeah, no, I think we can. I think it's possible. I think, again, you said earlier, you know, the question about realities and possibilities and it proves possibility. You know what? I can walk and you can walk probably a few hundred yards, maybe a couple of miles from each of our respective universities, and we could see this in action. Legal education is education for judgment. Medical education is education for judgment, right? These are places where actually people have to wrestle with, what does justice mean? How do we advance justice? And it's not so easy because you have to consider the different aspects of justice and what do we mean by a just society? And can something be just for the individual but challenging for the collectivity? Can something be just for the collectivity but in the process harm the individual? Physicians have to make all sorts of decisions about care and quality of care and the withholding of care if it about doing no harm first. And so, you know, I don't think we're asking for like, you know, some kind of quantum time travel machine here. The question is the fundamental one, which is, do we have the leadership in our own institutions who have the courage to actually do what leaders do, which is actually learn to be comfortable with being uncomfortable? Do we have people in our collective business education environment who actually say, if we just look at some of the basic metrics around which we should be judging our businesses, okay, we could start with some of the very important things that many of our colleagues care about, you know, is business able to handle sustainability issues, you know, the climate crisis, the questions about inequality and democracy. Let me just ask a very simple question. If we had to look at the one thing we ask business to do, which is produce good jobs for people, have they delivered on that fundamental good jobs for large numbers of people, jobs with some sense of career, jobs with dignity, jobs that have some sense of mobility? That's a simple one. Isn't that what business people are supposed to be doing? Delivering jobs? Can we say that the leaders of our institutions that we've educated have delivered high quality jobs for high quality people, not around the world, but even for people who they park in the same parking lot with? That would be the question. Let's just start there. You want to strip away everything else? Let's start there. Because everybody always describes themselves as a job creator. Well, do these jobs lead anywhere? Are they paid fairly? Are they broadly shared prosperity? Or do a narrow group of people walk away with most of the gains from productivity? Those are simple questions, but those are the kinds of questions that actually would require us to have an honest and candid conversation. But why should we think business education as an institution is any different from the other institutions that we've lost confidence in, including our universities?
Yeah, so on the one hand, there is a model of a professionalized sort of school, and some people would debate the benefit of the legal education and the medical education. I think that they are under similar stresses, at least the medical education in some way, where they are debating how can we be professional under those economistic logics. And they are entering, I think, the very same kind of dilemma. At the same time, this is or was core of the university as a institution, that we develop the elites, quote unquote, or those that are the leaders that we entrust leadership with, that they have a certain care and ability to care in a meaningful way. And you're specifying what that would look like for a normal business person. Like, how do you create jobs that are engaging or people feel energized through or feel dignified, etc. I use the example of an architecture school with the studios where they have to make, right? And that kind of thing that could also potentially be enlightening for some. And I think we have done that in business education where people do these projects and have to wrestle with more of it. But I do think there is this poverty of imagination that you're also mentioning in the beginning, where when a business student enters a conversation, it's almost always with the kind of, give me the costs, give me, wow, I can do efficiency, and I'm going to add value to you by telling you how you can market or something.
Yeah. So I think those are all great points, and I don't think I'm going to be able to address all of them, but I took some quick notes to see if I just can address a couple of them. And then I'll leave it with a kind of more general point. One is, wouldn't that be great even if, like, students were wrestling with these questions in the classroom? I think one of the challenges that we're seeing in business education is that it's quickly becoming commodified. That increasingly, if you read poets and quants and stuff, in many of our leading business school students basically see the education as the externality and the network as the purpose. So let's just start there with, you know, that we're also seeing a huge commodification of the two-year MBA. And many people are asking the question, is it worth going? And my question there is, you know, well, it depends what you think the purpose is. Are we teaching esoteric knowledge that's difficult to acquire outside of an educational setting? So you brought a really interesting example of, like, the kind of studio critique. But my understanding is that in many classrooms, people feel like they can't even, you know, have open conversations because they're afraid of being seen or described as a socialist because they have a sort of belief in progressive taxation, or being seen as a communist because they think that a union might have a legitimate effort. So let's just, like, even start. We can even have real Socratic dialogue. Because if you look at least some of the things that even schools are reporting in their own data, students are self-censoring. And if you're not sort of with the dominant paradigm, you're sort of seen as kind of, some outlier. And then you worry if the purpose is getting the network. Well, around networks, everybody's going to walk around eggshells because you're like, I don't know if this future person might be somebody I want to partner with. So let's just even talk about, like, what business schools have become in some ways, which is credentialing and networking. And for many people, worries that basically it's more about reproducing elites than actually educating people in the transformative power of what capitalism could do. And it's becoming more increasingly people of experiences. They're helping rich people stay rich rather than it's a system for creating social mobility and changing lives, right? Which is why many of us, I consider myself a capitalist, a private in the capitalist army. It's because I believe in the transformative power of capitalism, not because I thought capitalism was a racket. And I think, but part of that is you have to look at the indicators. Are we seeing more social mobility? Are we seeing good jobs? Are we seeing the kinds of industries that are contributing to human flourishing and well-being? So those are the kinds of metrics. You want to talk metrics? I'll talk metrics. And let's use all those indicators. Is human in the United States, is our mortality going up or down? What about addiction behaviors? What about a belief in democracy versus polarization? Let's talk about it. You want to talk about measurements? I'll talk measurements. Let's agree on them and let's not change them in the middle of our debate. Or if one challenges them, let's not result in calling people names. And let's be hard on the ideas and easy on each other. That's the sort of, but I think all of us need to participate in that dialogue and that debate. Now, the other thing that I would say is that the thing that, you know, why was it that many business schools wanted to be in universities? And this is something I think you probably know, probably being at Fordham, is that the roots of universities is they're sacred institutions. They are anchored and they came from religious. You know, my dissertation chair, as you know, I'm trained as an organizational sociologist. He always used to say to me, wherever you see robes and funny hats, that's sociology, right? We're a robed profession. That is that we attach ourselves to the moral centers of ultimate questions about things that matter, that things that transcend the immediate world, right? And we do that at convocation and we do that at commencement. I'm just saying, what are we going to do in between those two bookmarks, right? The attachment to the sacred cannot be evaded, right? All societies, as Edward Schills said, have and regard as sacred certain standards of judgment, certain ways that we relate to each other, certain ways that we arrange our society. And this sacredness of an institutional system is absolutely critical. It is partly what contributes to the social order. And the things that we often institutionalize, as you know from institutional theory, are the things that we begin to infuse meaning on beyond their original kind of technical function. and the historical heritage of education is religious, and consequently the view of a university as a sacred institution. And any time you, and I had this, I think, felt experience very deeply when I was the dean of the college at Harvard, was that any time you are educating society's young, you are engaged in a moral activity. And so as much as universities want to run away from this and talk about patents, and, you know, in their defensive posture now, all these wonderful contributions that we've made, universities, ultimately, their sacredness is because they see themselves as linked to truth. And if we don't believe truth matters, then universities don't matter. Because they're seen as a way that knowledge, just being knowledgeable, having a better understanding of your world, is better than ignorance. And these things just matter as ends in themselves. Not because they maximize shareholder value, not because they matter as ends in themselves. And what we've seen, I think, and I would argue, is a profaning of the university.
And that commodification and that kind of programming for market services in some way, I think, is probably part of that. And the justification, and I'm sure you've had to, you were in those conversations with, I think, all kinds of representative elites that were probably challenging that sacrality, that original moral kind of mission. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about recapturing that in this moment? Because as I think we've talked about this, this is like a fundamental challenge to many institutions, and many institutions are breaking down. What are your ways to see that we can capture some of the animating energies, logics, spirits,
yeah,
to build newly? And I'm giving you the context of Germany. I was like, when growing up there, that was like totally destroyed. And it was a great whatever history and everything. But then there were some years where some people, yeah, would know this is not going to last. But then they were talking about like, what do we need to build after? So I feel like we're in that moment. And so what do you see there? What can we build on? What is emerging? What do you think is worth considering as potentially a source of hope also, or maybe a guidance?
Great questions. And I think, you know, we should have alternatives. And I think we can look at different places. I know within our higher ed institutions, there are edges in which innovative ways of thinking about pedagogy, in which basically taking students outside of the classroom, bringing them into nature is a way of kind of deinstitutionalizing them, you know, is an important process. So I think, you know, there's a lot that we can start looking for. But the way I think about, you use the word hope, which is really an interesting word. You know, a lot of people think of hope as a future-oriented thing. And I often think about where hope really comes from is from one's past. So in my own family, you know, my parents were refugees from partition. And a few generations before that, they had been refugees, they're my ancestors. And the fact that they've overcome these difficulties, my parents came as immigrants, I came as immigrants, and they had challenges. So for me, a sense of hope comes from knowing that we've overcome things in the past. And so when I think about universities, which are among society's oldest institutions, I think I have a lot of hope because, you know, in fact, you know, as challenging and wonderful as universities are, they, you know, I know that can be difficult to run, but they are society's oldest institutions. And in some ways, I think they, because of their sacredness, they've had to adapt before and they've had to come out in different places. Now, my question, and this is going to sound a little bit probably more selfish than it needs to be, is I do believe universities will survive. My question is, will American universities, which will survive, but will they be the center of the kind of intellectual and social energy that they've been for the last century? You brought up Germany. If this was 100 years ago, say this was 1926, and we were to ask, what are the best universities in the world? Top 10. 8 of them would have been in Germany. Then 2 of them would have been Oxford and Cambridge, and you would have had lots of debates about the Sorbonne and Bologna. And you'd go down a little bit further before you'd get to an American university. We all know from actually the history of universities that the German universities were the model for the American research university. So my question is that it's almost going to be, we would be making a mistake that we try to teach our students about. If we're thinking that somehow it's just going to be a matter of us fixing ourselves, there's lots of other societies that would love to have be the next 100 years or 200 years of higher education dominance. There's societies who say, you know what? Let me bring together a place of transformation. Let me create a place of, and maybe this goes to your question. To me, the job of universities is actually one level very straightforward. It's to create knowledge and to transmit that knowledge to the next generation. It is a higher activity that basically tries to infuse in students a love and admiration for some of the best things human beings have ever done. It is a way of holding society's knowledge and values and transmitting them to the next generation, right? So there's like sort of not to be functionalist about it, but there's some functions that we engage and that we take care of. And how do we do it? Well, we have kind of, you know, so at Harvard College, as you say, the mission of Harvard College has been for almost four centuries now to educate the citizens and citizen leaders for our society. And we do this through our belief in the transformative power of a liberal arts and sciences education. And when I get underneath that, what do we mean by the transformative power of education? Well, intellectual transformation is first, which is that to learn to think for ourselves, to not think as part of the herd, to not think in a closed ideological system, in fact, to avoid totalizing systems. In fact, part of what I often, when I teach my, I'm also a faculty member in the sociology department, one of the things I try to teach my undergraduates is to smell ideology, you know, to smell ideology, closed systems of thought, systems that don't allow for variation or fuzziness and stuff. Because that's, you know, I want them to think for themselves and I want them to search for the truth, but recognize that the truth is not easily attained, right? The capital T truth is not easily attained. It's lots of small T truths. It requires being open to debate and discussion. And it requires the idea that you're willing to have your mind changed with evidence and reason. And even then, you should always have a little bit of healthy skepticism. And that in order to do that, in order to avoid, to really get to that idea of intellectual transformation, you also have to embed that in a very diverse living and learning environment where the students have different perspectives and points of view. And they learn to hear those perspectives and points of view. They learn to have an empathetic perspective rather than a kind of, if they hear something that challenges them, they turn to a pile of ashes or something like that. They learn to develop empathy, see behind each other's eyes, hear from another's perspective. And then if a university has really done its job, it leaves the students with three questions to answer for themselves. Who am I? Who am I and who do I want to be? How do I relate to others and what can I learn from others? What are my gifts and talents and how can I best use them to serve the world? So personal transformation. And our job is not to answer those questions for our students, but to give them the exposure to the text, to the classes, to the dialogue and the debate, the great debate, so that they can find the authentic answers for themselves. And that to me, again, is how do we reanimate that idea, which has literally been part of education since Socrates. That is really the object. And the pressures we're under is exactly what you said, is that market logic has not only imposed itself in corporations, it's jumped the track to shaping now how lawyers have to think about things, about how medicine, how even universities have to think about themselves. And that's the monolithic totalitarian totalizing logic that is also quite dangerous.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And I love the way that you frame it, those questions, those existential questions that people can elevate. And I think like, yeah, you come with those questions potentially and you don't have an answer for them after, but you have a higher level of ability to think about them productively for yourself and for others and with others. Where do you see this happening and captured newly? And if one was to rebuild and transform business education, where would you see opportunities to channel that idea and maybe build newly? Let's assume American universities are here to stay for sure, but there are others who can capture that spirit.
Well, I think one thing is that I've often believed that talent is everywhere, but opportunities are not. And so making sure there's never like a barrier to entry into the into the educational system, that we have to have an open society and we have to be open to that. And so I think making sure that we have as many opportunities for people where you're not judged at too early of an age and put on a track, and that the zip code that you're born in should not determine your life's chances and the opportunity structures that you have access to. So that's, to me, that's a societal level decision, because I think you know, there are periods where elite education has been for elites, and it's really been about, like, you know, inculcating a set of sort of affects and cultural capital, which is important, but it's not been open, and often it's very narrow. So how do we ensure that we are an open society? And for American universities, that's included making sure that we're open to talent where it comes from, especially in our graduate educations and things like that. So I think, you know, that's something we have to think deeply about. And we also have to make sure that it doesn't come at the expense, though, also that we are that we have healthy institutions in K-12. And given the unevenness of our K-12 education, it doesn't keep people out of the very systems that are supported by our tax holders and by our stakeholders, right? Which is partly why there's been distrust of American higher ed among many people. And so we have to really make sure that we have a little legitimacy with society. And right now, higher education is facing a lot of strain on that. I think, you know, where I see, again, you know, I think we have to create greater coalitions among the faculty. The one challenge that we have is we've had a huge bureaucratization of the university. And as a result of that, costs have gone very, very high. But if you look at the data, and I know the data pretty well, because I'm working on some research in this space, the number of students and the number of faculty have stayed the same. But the administrative intensity of the university has gone up significantly. And as a result, people who are occupying the senior positions in universities are often thinking about them as managing, you know, complex organizations and complex systems. And so they bring very much a kind of management logic to running the university. And by that, I mean is that they're focusing on things like, oh, how do we increase our efficiency, you know, and how do we coordinate meetings better? And how do we, you know, solve certain technical problems like yield management and enrollment management? And how do we administer, you know, certain kinds of structure? Now, that works probably fine and well if when, you know, the world is stable. But when the world is changing and uncertain, you need institutional leadership, which I think is distinct from management. It's one that we teach about, as you know. But I think in universities, it's about focusing on mission. It's about protecting values. It's about interpreting meaning and doing sense making about the environment. And it is about preserving institutional identity. And, you know, the challenge we face is that, you know, the systems for doing that are, you know, not easy to maintain. It's very easy for us to get overmanaged and underled. And I think that's partly what's also contributed to the legitimacy crisis that universities are facing.
Yeah, wonderful. There are so many, I think, further points to interject and continue. And I just thank you for your thoughtful leadership and challenge in many ways. And I know that you're working on some work on elites and something. Maybe you want to share before we end some of the highlights there, what got you to do this kind of work right now? And what is sort of your ambition for the next immediate future, so to speak? Yeah. And then I'd like you to give me a number from 1 to 35, and I'll give you the final question.
So I am doing, you know, I had always envisioned, you know, I've done a lot of work, as you said, you know, a lot of my early work was on the CEO labor market and how it wasn't really a market, and then studied universities and particularly management and professional schools and business education. And then I kind of did a little bit of a detour about whether these topics like leadership could actually be taught. Like, was there underlying theory and pedagogy underneath that? But I always had in mind a sort of third book in the trilogy on the sociology and organizational sociology of elites, which was on how did globalization impact the values of the American business elite. And so I am revising a book, which is why you're catching me in Copenhagen and then on my way, is I'm revising a book in which I look at the different stages in which kind of globalization emerged, sort of settings of the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in the 1970s, the contestation around how do we strengthen American business again. It was facing greater competition. There was a lot of inflation, stagflation, and the debate about, you know, how that should be done. And, you know, there was lots of questions about, you know, maybe greater industrial policy and new variation of like a kind of healthy balance between the interests of capital, labor, and broader society. And that debate was, you know, on the other side was the, where we were talking about earlier was, no, what we, you know, was the kind of Thatcher, Reagan, what we need to do is just, you know, there's no such thing as society. What we need to do is just, you know, deregulate, and, you know, encourage kind of free market enterprise. And that's how that, but that also created a set of conditions in which I talk about the different regimes around as we transfer from international business to multinational, and then really seeing firms and the people seeing themselves as kind of global. And in particular, what impact that had on the identities of the leaders about who they thought they were responsible to and what was the logics that they used. Because I think we're now seeing the backlash of that. My research setting are international NGOs like the World Economic Forum, but also, you know, looking at things like the G8 and those kind of things, where these kind of systems of thought and concepts of governance are constructed. And so I'm doing a lot of work there. And then on the side, I'm doing a lot of kind of just back to my kind of old organizational sociology type of work on bureaucracy. And in particular, the bureaucratization of why it is in certain settings, bureaucracy just continues to sort of grow despite everybody thinking it's actually inhibiting us. And part of what I argue is there's a kind of structural logic to bureaucracy, but also we can't imagine increasingly alternatives to bureaucracy. Well, you know, very rarely when I was dean did I not have somebody in my office come and point out a problem. And the solution was, well, there ought to be an office, or there ought to be an assistant dean, or there ought to be a rule, rather than other ways that we could organize ourselves. So I'm working on some, you know, conceptual, but also some empirical papers. I just presented an empirical paper yesterday on the bureaucratic roots of the legitimacy crisis in higher education. So that's what I'm working on.
Wow. Wow. Well, thank you. And I'm excited to read more, hear more, because I do think in that kind of work, there are probably the seeds for the next level evolution of what I think will probably remain at least a universalist challenge, right?
Yeah.
We do have a universalist challenge, and the university, I think, can contribute meaningfully if it decides to, and maybe the business school can too. And I think there are probably ways to learn from where that could happen.
Yeah. Well, before we go, I want to thank you, Michael, for, you know, you're the host and you've been so kind in asking questions. But I want to thank you for the work that you've been doing for these last several years as a kind of institutional builder and reimaginer. I think you are doing so much to have institutions and individuals, especially faculty, kind of cultivate a habit of reflexivity and reflection. I remember we met many years ago, and I loved always speaking to you, and to see you evolve from that to being a mentor to so many people is just amazing. And I think also the fact that you're also bringing a systems level thinking here. And I just think that that combination of leadership and empowering people is something that we're going to benefit from. You have planting trees whose shade future generations will enjoy. So just want to express my gratitude to you on that.
Well, thank you. And I would love to continue this and just see how we can do this together, because I think this is a community ship kind of project, right? This is something that people like us have the privilege to contribute to. So I thank you so much for the acknowledgement, but also for your work. And I wish to continue the cross-fertilization. I want to ask you one last question, because it's just a routine. Give me a number from 1 to 35.
I have no idea what to get. So I'm just going to give a number 22.
22. Okay. What is your most treasured possession? Okay, great. Great. Well, Rakesh, such a pleasure. I thank you so much. And to be continued.
Semper Veritas.
Thank you. Semper Veritas. I love that. Yes.
Bye-bye.